Chapter 3, The Godward Emotions. We're a couple of pages into this essay. Sri Aurobindo writes, "This relation of the Divine Fatherhood and the closer relation with the Divine as the Mother Soul of the universe have their springs in another early religious motive. One type of the bhakta, says the Gita, is the devotee who comes to the Divine as the giver of his wants, the giver of his good, the satisfier of the needs of his inner and his outer being. I bring to my bhakta, says the Lord, his getting and his having of good, yogakshemam vahami aham. This is from the Gita, chapter 9. It's the 22nd shloka, and it means literally, I carry the secured possessions. The life of man is a life of wants and needs, and therefore of desires, not only in his physical and vital, but in his mental and spiritual being. When he becomes conscious of a greater power governing the world, he approaches it through prayer for the fulfillment of his needs, for help in his rough journey, for protection and aid in his struggle." Sri Aurobindo, of course, references the Bhagavad Gita here, but there is another text that perhaps never came to his hand, which is in the Shakta tradition, called Devi Gita. And let me read to you first the Bhagavad Gita, the shloka we cited, the 22nd and the 9th chapter, in English. And then we'll read a similar passage from the Devi Gita. "To those who worship me, making me alone the whole object of their thought, to those constantly in yoga with me, I spontaneously bring every good." Sri Aurobindo's rendering. Use the Devi Gita. "With undistracted devotion and joy, inclining your heart to me in love, worship me, fulfill me with tapasya and your self-offering." That's in the 9th chapter also. It's the 11th verse. And the principal goddess form being worshipped is Bhuvaneshwari. So whether seen as Ishvara, the Purushottama of the Gita, or Ishvari, the supreme goddess, it is a recognition of a sovereign power who has placed the universe in manifestation from within its own being. It is not a creation ex nihilo, out of nothing, standing apart and outside the divine. It is an expression of the divine essence itself. So to approach it, to have an initial contact, whatever brings you there is a good path. Whatever kindles aspiration, a budding wish to communicate, is all good. He continues, "Whatever crudities there may be in the ordinary religious approach to God by prayer, and there are many, especially that attitude which imagines the divine as if capable of being propitiated, bribed, flattered into acquiescence or indulgence by praise, entreaty, and gifts, and has often little regard to the spirit in which he is approached, still, this way of turning to the divine is an essential movement of our religious being and reposes on a universal truth. So every way is a welcome way, because any beginning has also a destination and an end. So let us not have contempt for anything that gets a person started. The efficacy of prayer is often doubted, and prayer itself supposed to be a thing irrational and necessarily superfluous and ineffective. And this is a long debate in 19th century Western theology. It is true that the universal will executes always its aim and cannot be deflected by egoistic propitiation and entreaty. It is true of the transcendent who expresses himself in the universal order that being omniscient, his larger knowledge must foresee the thing to be done, and it does not need direction or stimulation by human thought, and that the individual's desires are not and cannot be in any world order the true determining factor. So he writes amusingly. But neither is that order or the execution of the universal will altogether affected by mechanical law, but by powers and forces of which, for human life at least, human will, aspiration, and faith are not among the least important. Its forms are very often crude and not only childlike, which is in itself no defect, but childish, but still it has a real power and significance. Its power and sense is to put the will, aspiration, and faith of man into touch with the divine will as that of a conscious being with whom we can enter into conscious and living relations. So prayer is a mode by which we reach up and stretch our hand out, lift our voice, and beckon. For our will and aspiration can act either by our own strength and endeavor, which can no doubt be made a thing great and effective, whether for lower or higher purposes. And there are plenty of disciplines which put it forward as the one force to be used. Or it can act in dependence upon and with subordination to the divine or the universal will. And this latter way, again, may either look upon that will as responsive indeed to our aspiration, but almost mechanically, by a sort of law of energy, or at any rate, quite impersonally. Or else it may look upon it as responding consciously to the divine aspiration and faith of the human soul, and consciously bringing to it the help, the guidance, the protection, and fruition demanded. Yoga kshemam bahami aham. Again. So prayer is important. Prayer helps to prepare this relation for us at first, on the lower plane, even while it is there consistent with much that is mere egoism and self-delusion. But afterwards, we can draw towards the spiritual truth which is behind it. It is not then the giving of the thing asked for that matters, but the relation itself, the contact of man's life with God, the conscious interchange. In spiritual matters and in the seeking of spiritual gains, this conscious relation is a great power, It is a much greater power than our own entirely self-reliant struggle and effort, and it brings a fuller spiritual growth and experience. Necessarily, in the end, prayer either ceases in the greater thing for which it prepared us. In fact, the form we call prayer is not itself essential, so long as the faith, the will, the aspiration are there, or remains only for the joy of the relation, because you want to talk to the divine. Also, its objects, the artha, or interest it seeks to realize, become higher and higher until we reach the highest motiveless devotion, which is that of divine love, pure and simple, without any other demand or longing. Mother's stages of love, again. Love me and I'll see if I love you. Another. I'll love you as long as you love me. A third. I'll love you whether you love me or not. And the highest, I simply love. The relations which arise out of this attitude towards the divine are that of the divine father and the divine, The relations which arise out of this attitude towards the divine are that of the divine father and the mother with the child, and that of the divine friend. So he'll treat all three relationships. To the divine, as these things, the human soul comes for help, for protection, for guidance, for fruition, or if knowledge be the aim, to the guide, teacher, giver of light, for the divine is the sun of knowledge, or it comes in pain and suffering for relief and solace and deliverance. It may be deliverance either from the suffering itself or from the world existence, which is the habitat of the suffering, or from all its inner and real causes. He notes here, these are three of the four classes of devotee which are recognized by the Gita: artha, artharthi, jignasu, the distressed, the seeker of personal objects, and the seeker of God knowledge. This is Bhagavad Gita chapter 7, verses 16 and 17. And of course, the fourth is the knower, the jnani. But what does he know? What he knows, he loves. And eventually, what he loves, he serves in the world. In these things, we find there is a certain gradation. For the relation of fatherhood is always less close, intense, passionate, intimate, and therefore it is less resorted to in the yoga which seeks for the closest union. That of the divine friend is a thing sweeter and more intimate, admits of an equality and intimacy, even in inequality, and the beginning of mutual self-giving. At its closest, when all idea of other giving and taking disappears, when this relation becomes motiveless, except for the one sole, all-sufficing motive of love, it turns into the free and happy relation of the playmate in the lila of existence. But closer and more intimate still is the relation of the mother and the child, and that therefore plays a very large part wherever the religious impulse is most richly fervent and springs most warmly from the heart of man. The soul goes to the mother soul in all its desires and troubles, and the Divine Mother wishes that it should be so, so that she may pour out her heart of love. It turns to her too, because of the self-existent nature of this love, and because that points us to the home towards which we turn from our wanderings in the world, and to the bosom in which we find our rest. The self-existent nature of love and delight, Satchit Ananda Rupani, Sri Lalita Sahasranam. Of course, this idea of the Divine Mother is not a theory in India. It is a millenniums-old living tradition. It has not gone away. It is not merely extant. It pulsates with life. By the way, those verses from the Gita, chapter 7, 16 and 17. Among the virtuous who turn to me with devotion, there are four kinds of bhaktas. So they are all devotees, seeking attachment, seeking connection with the divine. The seeker for good in the world, the seeker who wants to cease suffering, the seeker for knowledge, and the knower. Of these, the knower, in constant devotion and union with the one, is the best. That one loves me perfectly and is my beloved. So there we have it stated plainly. This is a reunion of the particle with the whole, of the individual with the universal, with the essence of the individual soul, with the essence of all. But the highest and the greatest relation is that which starts from none of the ordinary religious motives, but is rather of the very essence of yoga, springs from the very nature of love itself. It is the passion of the lover and the beloved. Wherever there is the desire of the soul for its utter union with God, this form of the divine yearning makes its way even into religions which seem to do without it and give it no place in their ordinary system. So we find this in what we commonly call Hinduism, or the bhakti tradition in India. We find this in devotionalism, mystic devotion in Islam, in the movement of the Sufi and Rumi. We find it in mystical tracts in Christianity with Saint Teresa de Avila, with Brother Lawrence, and earlier with Meister Eckhart. Here, the one thing asked for is love. The one thing feared is the loss of love. The one sorrow is the sorrow of separation of love. For all other things either do not exist for the lover, or come in only as incidents or as results, and not as objects or conditions of love. All love is indeed in its nature self-existent, because it springs from a secret oneness in being, and a sense of that oneness or desire of oneness in the heart between souls that are yet able to conceive of themselves as different from each other and divided. Remember our study of the life divine. It is in the expression of Satchit Ananda, in its vast consciousness as the supramental gnosis, in that stage in which diversity begins to come out of the oneness, and the oneness is fully present, and each element of the diversity looks back at the one from which it comes, and looks at the all in which it sits, and knows each and all as the same thing. That is where it stems from, and there manifests here. Increasingly, in our seemingly obscure world. So it begins as a supramental radiance, and here is undertaking as a gleam to become that same light. But it is based in the ananda of oneness, in that delight. So, if you'll permit me, I'll read something translated into English from the old German. This is Meister Eckhart. Oh, my dear one, what harm does it do you to allow God to be God in you? Go completely out of yourself for God's love, and God comes completely out of himself for love of you. And when these two have gone out, what remains is simply the one. This is as fine an expression of theistic Vedanta as anything that we have. Meister Eckhart. Therefore, all these other relations too can arrive at their self-existent, motiveless joy of being for the sake of love alone. But still they start from and to the end, they to some extent find a satisfaction of their play and other motives. But here the beginning is love, and the end is love, and the whole aim is love. There is indeed the desire of possession, but even this is overcome in the fullness of this self-existent love, and the final demand of the bhakta is simply that his bhakti may never cease nor diminish. Narada Bhakti Sutras 19. He does not ask for heaven or for liberation from birth or for any other object, but only that his love may be eternal and absolute. Love is a passion, and it seeks for two things, eternity and intensity. And in the relation of the lover and beloved, the seeking for eternity and for intensity is instinctive and self-born. Love is the seeking for mutual possession, and it is here that the demand for mutual possession becomes absolute. And this is echoed in Narada Bhakti Sutras 6 and 7. Passing beyond desire of possession, which means a difference, it is a seeking for oneness. And it is here that the idea of oneness, of two souls merging into each other and becoming one, finds the acme of its longing and the utterness of its satisfaction. Yes, this is what yoga means. Reunification if there is division. Love, too, is a yearning for beauty, and it is here that the yearning is eternally satisfied in the vision and the touch and the joy of the all beautiful. Love is a child and a seeker of delight, and it is here that it finds the highest possible ecstasy, both of the heart consciousness and of every fiber of the being. Moreover, this relation is that which, as between human being and human being, demands the most, and even while reaching the greatest intensities, is still the least satisfied, because only in the divine can it find its real and its utter satisfaction. Therefore, it is here most that the turning of human emotion Godwards finds its full meaning and discovers all the truth of which love is the human symbol, all its essential instincts divinized, raised, satisfied in the bliss from which our life was born, and towards which by oneness it returns in the ananda of the divine existence, where love is absolute, eternal, and unalloyed. And I think by now you know that's the Taittiriya Upanishad. The common nature of love and delight. And to continue the theme, we can go to Book 11 in Savitri, the Book of Everlasting Day, the Soul's Choice and the Supreme Consummation. And we can read from a place on page 702. Bottom half of the page. You are my force at work to uplift Earth's fate, myself that moves up the immense incline between the extremes of the spirit's night and day. He is my soul that climbs from nescient night through life and mind and supernature's vast, to the supernal light of timelessness, and my eternity hid in moving time, and my boundlessness cut by the curve of space. It climbs to the greatness it has left behind, and to the beauty and joy from which it fell, to the closeness and sweetness of all things divine, to light without bounds and life illimitable, taste of the depths of the ineffable's bliss, touch of the immortal and the infinite. He is my soul that gropes out of the beast to reach humanity's heights of lucent thought and the vicinity of truth sublime. He is the Godhead growing in human lives and in the body of earth beings' forms. He is the soul of man climbing to God in nature's surge out of earth's ignorance. O Savitri, thou art my spirit's power, the revealing voice of my immortal word, the face of truth upon the roads of time, pointing to the souls of men, the roots to God. While the dim light from the veiled spirit's peak falls upon matter's stark inconscient sleep, as if a pale moonbeam on a dense glade, and mind as a half-light moves amid half-truths, and the human heart knows only human love, and life is a stumbling and imperfect force, and the body counts out its precarious days, you shall be born into man's dubious hours, in forms that hide the soul's divinity, and show through veils of the earth's doubting air my glory, breaking as through clouds a sun, or burning like a rare and inward fire, and with my nameless influence fill men's lives. Yet shall they look up as to peaks of God, and feel God like a circumambient air, and rest on God as on a motionless base. Yet shall there glow on mind like a horned moon, the spirit's crescent splendor in pale skies, and light man's life upon his Godward road. Namaste. Jai Ma.